and welcome to the iFormRx podcast, where we explore the evidence that informs ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, and today we're going to be talking about the secondary prevention of stroke. While direct oral anticoagulants, or more affectionately known as DOACs, have steadily replaced warfarin for stroke prevention in patients with atrial fibrillation, there continues to be some debate about whether they are the best choice in very high-risk patients, namely older adults who have already experienced a thromboembolic stroke. Because warfarin use requires frequent contact with the healthcare system, some think that the additional touch points might lead to improved health outcomes in this very high-risk population. Well, the PROSPER study, published in July 2019 in JAMA Neurology, attempted to address this important question. And joining me today to talk about the PROSPER study and its application to practice are Amber Cheesmich, Blair White, and Leticia Smith. Dr. Cheesmich and Smith are clinical pharmacy specialists, and Dr. White is a PGY2 ambulatory care pharmacy resident, and all of them practice with Denver Health in Denver, Colorado. Amber, Blair, Tisha, welcome to the iFormRx podcast.
Thank you, Stuart, for that introduction. We're excited to be with you today.
Thanks, Stuart. So happy to be here.
Thanks, Stuart.
So before we get started, I want you to imagine you're seeing TR, a 78-year-old Latin American female, in the primary care clinic today for follow-up after her discharge from hospital 2 weeks ago after suffering an ischemic stroke due to atrial fibrillation. According to the patient, she still has some right-sided weakness but is able to ambulate with a walker. She also has some difficulty articulating words due to some facial weakness. She was discharged from hospital to a rehabilitation facility where she received physical and occupational therapy, and then she was discharged home yesterday. She lives with her 81-year-old husband, and their oldest daughter has moved back home to assist them. TR has a long-standing history of hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and is overweight, but prior to this hospitalization, she was unaware that she had atrial fibrillation. The patient currently takes lisinopril 20 milligrams daily, chlorothalidone 25 milligrams daily, metformin 850 milligrams twice daily, and insulin glargine 34 units, which she takes at bedtime. She was started on apixaban 5 milligrams twice daily during her hospitalization, and she was able to obtain a 30-day supply of the medication yesterday after a discharge from the rehabilitation facility. She currently weighs 197 pounds, and her BMI is 33.1. Her blood pressure today is 122 over 56, and she had a Chem7 and A1C drawn this morning. Her electrolytes were all within normal limits, but her fasting serum glucose was 144 milligrams per deciliter. Her serum creatinine was 1.6 milligrams per deciliter, and her A1C was 7.9%. So, Blair, before we talk about the PROSPER study, can you tell me a little bit about what's going through your mind in a case like this? What additional information might you want to collect and assess during this encounter? And are there any treatment changes you'd be considering at this point?
I can certainly talk about what's kind of going through my head as you presented this patient case. First thing that comes to mind is you mentioned she has a husband and a daughter at home currently. I was wondering if the patient is independent or is she relying heavily on them to perform her activities of daily living. I would like to know if she's adherent to her current medications. This would help me determine if she's capable of taking a medication twice a day or if once daily option would be better for her. I would also want to know if she has any issues affording her medications. Is her creatinine labile or is it stable at 1.6? And additionally, does she have any history of bleeds? I noticed, based on the medications that you read off for the patient, she doesn't currently have anything on board for rate or rhythm control, so I'd be curious as to why she's not on that type of medication. We don't necessarily need her creatinine clearance to determine if her apixaban dose is appropriate for her atrial fibrillation, but based on her actual body weight, her creatinine clearance is right around 40 milliliters per minute. I think the patient's current dose of apixaban at 5 milligrams twice a day is appropriate for her atrial fibrillation. She only meets one of the criterion for dose adjustment. Her serum creatinine is greater than 1.5. And then I think it's also important to keep in mind that her CHADS2 VAS score is 7, so she is at fairly high risk of stroke. So those are just some things going through my mind with her stroke risk specifically. As far as her blood pressure control goes, you could say her blood pressure was controlled today at 122 over 56, but I do think her diastolic pressure is particularly low. I'd want to know if she's had any dizziness or lightheadedness recently or any recent falls. I do think it's important to maintain blood pressure control for this patient given her history of stroke, but I think we could consider decreasing or eliminating chlorthalidone as it's a very potent diuretic, especially for an older female who's 78 years old. With regards to her diabetes, I do think an A1C goal of less than 8% is reasonable given her age and her comorbidities. So her A1C at 7.9% is currently at goal. Her GFR currently is 33 milliliters per minute, and for this reason, I do recommend decreasing her metformin dose to 500 milligrams twice a day.
So, Amber, let's talk about the results of the PROSPER study. The paper was published in JAMA Neurology and is entitled Clinical Effectiveness of Direct Oral Anticoagulants versus Warfarin in Older Patients with Atrial Fibrillation and Ischemic Stroke, Findings from the Patient-Centered Research into Outcomes Stroke Patients Prefer and Effectiveness Research, or PROSPER study. For those in our audience who haven't read the paper, can you give us a brief summary of the methodology and its key findings?
Absolutely. So the PROSPER study was a retrospective observational analysis that was conducted between October 2011 and December 2014, primarily looking at the real-world clinical effectiveness of DOACs versus warfarin for secondary stroke prevention in older survivors of ischemic stroke with atrial fibrillation. Included in the study were anticoagulant naive patients who were older than 65 years, and they were categorized into two different groups. The first group were those prescribed warfarin, and the second group were those prescribed DOACs. Now, given the time frame of when this study was conducted, the DOACs available at that time were dabigatran, rivaroxaban, and apixaban. Now, the primary outcomes of the study were major adverse cardiovascular events, often referred to as MACE, as well as a more patient-centered outcome of home time. And they define home time as the total number of days alive and out of the hospital or a skilled nursing facility during the first year after having the index stroke event. And then the secondary outcomes included all-cause mortality, fatal bleeding, and also readmission for various reasons. There were a little over 11,600 patients included in the study. Approximately one-third of them were on DOACs. The median age was 80 years old. A little more than half of them were female, and 87% were white. The median CHADS VAS score for the patients prior to their stroke was 4, but the reasons for not being on anticoagulation prior to the stroke was not disclosed. The baseline characteristics were similar amongst the two groups, with the exception of the NIHSS score, and this is the National Institutes of Health Stroke Scale, which was actually slightly higher in the warfarin group. Another difference between the two groups was the zip code level unemployment rate, and this was also slightly higher in the warfarin group. Now, as far as the results go, the major findings from this study essentially showed us that patients on DOAC therapy had statistically significantly more days at home, or that home time after discharge, and they were also less likely to experience major adverse cardiovascular events. Additionally, the patients on DOAC therapy had lower rates of all-cause mortality, all-cause readmissions, cardiovascular readmissions, as well as hemorrhagic stroke. The DOAC group did, however, have a small but still significant increased risk of gastrointestinal bleeding. Now, they did a sensitivity analysis for the differences in baseline characteristics, and the results did not change.
So, Tisha, the investigators elected to use, I think, a rather unique endpoint, which they called home time, as the primary outcome in the study. I'm wondering what you think about this choice. Do you think this is a patient-centered outcome that should be used in other post-stroke studies and perhaps other studies like studies of stage 3 and 4 congestive heart failure or late-stage COPD trials?
Yeah, honestly, when I first read this study, I was not in favor of home time being used as the primary outcome, but I do like the idea of a patient-centered approach, and home time does correlate with the modified Rankin scale score, which is a gold standard measure of functional status used in other stroke trials. So in the end, I do think that it's an important outcome to study in this patient population, and since the study did also look at MACE, the use of home time I felt was appropriate. As for looking at home time in other patient populations, such as heart failure and COPD, I feel these high-risk patients need another level of care in the late stages of the disease, and there are already a number of studies looking at these patients' populations and their readmission rates, such as the PARADIGM-HF, which used the primary endpoint of a composite of CV death and heart failure hospitalization. Not to mention, these patients are also likely to have more frequent follow-up with provider following hospitalization for medication titration and symptom management. Close follow-up could either be beneficial to helping the patient stay out of the hospital, or they could end up being readmitted into the hospital. The advantage of taking a DOAC is less follow-up is needed, and therefore this truly does result in increased home time.
So, Tisha, beyond the use of home time as the primary outcome, what do you consider to be some of the strengths and weaknesses of the PROSPER study? Are there any confounders that you think may have influenced the results? And what about the study's generalizability?
As for the strengths of the study, they did look at a higher risk patient population based on advanced age. They did have increased bleed risk and more comorbidities. The mean age of the PROSPER trial was 80 years compared to the lower 70s of the other landmark trials, Aristotle, RELY, and Rocket AF. Some of the weaknesses of the study is that it was a retrospective observational analysis. The Get With The Guidelines stroke registry only included patients who had already had a stroke and cannot be extrapolated to those needing primary prevention. The study also excluded those that did not have a complete NIHSS score, as well as those missing renal function information, and individuals with severe stroke were not discharged on anticoagulation, all of which could potentially introduce selection bias. And lastly, there could be a bias against patients who were prescribed warfarin, as these patients might have stayed in the hospital longer or been discharged to a SNF for close INR monitoring. Some possible confounders might be adherence, as this data was not collected, and dosing strategies for DOACs were also unknown. With regards to generalizability, I do believe the study is generalizable, as other studies have not focused on this particular age of patients. The 2019 BEERS criteria currently recommends to use caution in patients greater than or equal to 75 years of age if prescribing dabigatran or rivaroxaban, which might steer providers to using warfarin over a DOAC or prescribing a lower dose of DOAC than appropriate, due to the fear of the unknown. And now, rather than extrapolating the results from other trials, we can say that DOACs are as efficacious in our elderly population and do not pose an increased bleed risk when compared to warfarin. PROSPER has shown that this older population has had more days at home, in addition to a lower risk of MACE and lower readmission with bleeding when compared to warfarin. And although DOAC did show a small but slightly significant higher risk of GI bleed, this is consistent with what was also found in the landmark trials.
So Blair, back to you. Let's go back to our case. What should we do? Do you think apixaban is the best choice for this patient, or would you advocate for rivaroxaban or perhaps warfarin instead? And if a DOAC is used, how would you go about monitoring and following up this patient, given that routine blood tests are generally unnecessary?
So as Tisha mentioned, we know that DOACs are as efficacious as warfarin, and in this patient specifically, we don't have a reason to avoid DOACs, so therefore I would recommend continuing a DOAC for this patient. We don't have head-to-head studies for DOACs, so patient-specific factors need to be taken into consideration when choosing one over the other. I think it's appropriate to continue apixaban 5 milligrams twice a day. If a patient struggles with adherence, I think that's when rivaroxaban would be a better option given its once daily dosing. Based on this patient's creatinine clearance of around 40 using actual body weight, I do recommend dose reduced rivaroxaban at 15 milligrams a day if this is to be used. If the cost of DOAC is of concern to the patient and the patient is able to come in for INR checks, I think warfarin would be reasonable as well. If a DOAC is used, monitoring that I would recommend, I think it's really important to assess the patient's adherence to the medication. So whether that's calling the patient and following up to make sure they're taking the medicine or calling the patient's pharmacy to assess their refill history. I think it's important to monitor if the patient's having any unusual bruising or bleeding. I also think it's important to monitor the patient's kidney function. Every 3 to 6 months, I think, would be reasonable in this patient, depending on the stability of her kidney function. She is older, and her creatinine clearance is slightly low. And then hepatic function annually is also important to monitor for these patients. I think it would be beneficial for the patient to get connected for close monitoring of anticoagulation with a pharmacist in clinic. That would be particularly beneficial for the patient.
I want to thank you all for joining me today to discuss the secondary prevention of stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. I think it's clear from your comments that you believe that DOACs are an effective and generally safe option for patients, even elderly patients, where we've had a general lack of data in the past, and in patients who have already experienced an ischemic stroke due to atrial fibrillation. So these data are helpful in terms of making decisions about who is a good candidate for DOACs. Well, tell us what you think. Only iFormRx members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iFormRx. It's free, so sign up today. And by the way, if you are a board-certified ambulatory care pharmacist, I hope you'll take advantage of the American Pharmacists Association's board recertification program. We've partnered with APHA to offer this commentary and podcast for board recertification credit. To learn more, click on the link at the bottom of the written commentary posted on the iFormRx website. And lastly, I want to send out a special thanks to the many volunteers who make iFormRx possible. A big shout out to Gary Thielman, one of my colleagues here at the University of Mississippi, who does a lot of the behind-the-scenes work that makes iFormRx possible. Gary is our managing editor and ensures that our website is up and running every day. On more than one occasion, Gary has had to troubleshoot a problem, which always seems to occur at night or on a weekend. So thank you, Gary. We really could not do this without you. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, signing off.